I now call to order the meeting, today's meeting of the House Resources Committee. Today is March 1st. It is 1:38 p.m. We are in room 124 of the Alaska State Capitol. I have present today Representative Sadler, Representative Wright, Representative Rauscher, Representative McCabe, Representative Dibert, Representative Armstrong, Representative Mears, and myself, Chairman Tom McKay. We do have enough to do business with a quorum. I see no other representatives or senators present in the gallery. I'd like to thank Justin and Zach and my committee aide, Ed King, today for helping us keep the meeting going on schedule. I would remind everyone, please silence your cell phones. By opening, we have two items on today's agenda. First, we will consider adopting a committee substitute for House Bill 50. Then we will get an introduction to the carbon credits market covered under House Bill 49. So first, we take up HB 50, carbon storage. We will bring HB 50 back before the committee. This is our eighth hearing on HB 50. My goal for today is to consider adopting a committee substitute as our working document and understanding the changes it includes. I will then set the bill aside to allow members time to draft any amendments they may have.
At ease.
Brief at ease. Okay, we're back on the record. I'd like to bring back before the committee HB 50, carbon storage. Okay. All right, this is our eighth hearing on HB 50. My goal for today is to consider adopting a committee substitute as our working document and understanding the changes that the CS includes. There's been a number of changes since we were first presented with this bill. I think it must have been 3 or 4 weeks ago. I will then set the bill aside to allow members of the committee time to draft any amendments that they may wish to submit. So with that, Mr. Vice Chair, do you have a motion?
Yes. I guess at this time I move the committee adopt work order. I'm sorry. I move at this time the committee adopt work order 33GH1567/S as our working document.
And I object for discussion purposes. So at this time, I'd like to invite Mr. Ed King, our committee aide who has worked on this bill, as well as any personnel from the DNR, to the table to address member questions on the CS. So to begin with, Mr. Ed King will provide a summary of the changes that have been made to bring us to this point in time. So, Mr. King, when you're ready, please proceed. And I would refer the members to the, there should be a memo attached to your bill that lists the changes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Ed King, staff to Chair McKay. Mr. Chairman, there's several changes in the bill. Most of them are technical in nature due to the drafting changes that were made by our legislative legal team. I won't go through every technical change, but I will highlight some of the major ones. The first change was to the title. The title was expanded to encapsulate everything that's in the bill by our legal services team. Change number two is the addition of two new sections to the bill, sections 4 and 5. You can locate those on chapter 2 on page 2 beginning on line 14. The third change was clarifying language around the closure trust fund statutes. These changes were requested by the administration. The changes to this section begin on page 2 line 24 and extend through page 3 line 10. And if there are questions, Mr. Chairman, we're happy to address them as we go through.
Okay, very good. Please proceed.
The fourth change is in reference to the rental payments in the sections related to late charges. These sections on page 4, there are four changes on lines 15, 20, 22, and 29. In each of the changes, the references to rental payments were removed and the references to injection charges remain. This again was a request by the administration. The fifth change is just a technical change made by our lawyers to redraft the proposed amendment to subsection B within 3805-184 to instead create a new subsection H. That change is located on page 5, beginning on line 29. The next change, Mr. Chairman, change number 6, was to delete the policy statements in both of the DNR and the AOGC statute sections. This is mostly intent language. In general, our legislative lawyers discourage intent or policy language in bills, and so it was removed. Change number 7 was to the minimum lease payments. This was language that was referred to by the department within a committee hearing last week, I believe. This removes references to minimum requirements for acreage, rental fees, and injection charges, and instead directs the commissioner to determine that in regulation.
Okay. Rep. Mears has a question.
Thank you, through the chair. Could you just explain that a little bit more for the record, why those were removed? Thank you.
It's for the record, again, Ed King for the record, Mr. Chairman. The changes in the bill are on page 6, lines 12 through 14. In the previous version, they are on page 6, line 31 through page 7, line 2. These were effectively removes the minimum requirement for $20 per acre and the $2.50 injection charge, and instead directs the department to establish market rates in regulation. I would point out, Mr. Chairman, that this language is still imperfect, and the committee may consider an amendment to further tighten up this language, but I'll let the department speak to why that's the case.
Hey, Mr. Crowther, would you like to expand on that, please?
Yeah, Chair McKay, for the record, this is John Crowther, Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources. Just speaking to the overall policy intent of the change, is a rapidly developing market for these CCUS projects, and in our reality from our assessment, some of them are very challenged by their economics. It's hard to identify set floors that both will allow projects to proceed, but also capture the best value for the state over the life of the project. And so you know, in the course of our overview of existing agreements for CCUS projects, we've identified several different kinds of terms that are used to recoup value. But we also, many of these agreements are by private landowners, so we're not able to review those terms. And so we want that flexibility in the statute to allow subsequent regulations with public process to further define those terms as we see the market mature and we see the kinds of projects that are proposed in Alaska.
Okay, Rep. Mears, are you okay? All right, Rep. Sadler.
Hey, Mr. Chair, is it your intention to allow questions on each of these changes? Do you want to let them run through the whole thing first before we dive in?
Well, we probably should ask questions as we go through them, I think. Otherwise, we'll get too far ahead, I think.
And to that point, then.
Okay.
In that case, to the Chair, Commissioner Designee Crowther. So in Change 7, looking on that, we're talking about, could you just define the terms generally for those of us who are not in the commercial business? What are commercial terms and economic terms? Other economic terms sounds like a pretty broad. I just want to understand what these would encompass.
Yeah, Representative Sadler, through the chair, for the record, John Crowther, Deputy Commissioner here. So, as you mentioned, the text of the committee substitute reads: the commissioner shall establish in regulation commercial terms for exploration license fees, annual lease rentals, lease injection charges, and other economic terms. So for a land right, there's often a rental type rate. For a process type use of land, there's often a fee based on the amount of that activity that occurs. So those would be examples of annual lease rentals and lease injection charges. But there's certainly other potential economic terms that are based on things like project revenues, other incentives or credits that the project may generate or participate in that may generate value for the operator that the state could participate in if identified in the leasing instrument. And so we don't know what all those may be yet, but we have seen that a variety of them are used across existing agreements, and we expect that those will evolve as the market evolves. So having a fixed single option in statute would be limiting in our view.
Follow up?
So you spoke of incentives and credits. I just want to differentiate. Are commercial terms between that's not between the state and the injector. That's between the injector and some other entity. Would it be commercial terms?
Yeah, Representative Sadler, at a conceptual level, currently under federal law, these projects would benefit from federal incentives. And so it's possible that we might want to tie state benefits. If there's changes to increase federal incentives, the state may want to participate in those. We have seen some examples of that in other agreements.
Okay.
Rep. Armstrong.
Thanks, through the chair. And sorry if I'm missing something, but I see on page 6, line 30, that we still have that $20 an acre minimum in there. So was the intent to remove that, or we're keeping that? Sorry, if you can just walk me through it.
Yes. Thank you. Mr. Chairman, this is Ed King again for the record. Yes, Mr. Chairman, we also identified that as an area of deficiency that should be amended.
Okay, very good. Please continue.
The next change, Mr. Chairman, is change number 8. This is related to the exploration license for storage. There were some terms in version A on page 6 between lines 14 and 17. We consolidate, or the committee substitute consolidates those terms into the statute 3805715. And those changes, or you can find those terms now on page 10, line 14 through 16 in the new version. Change number 9 is related to the renewal process. This language was intended to, rather than create the confusion of the term of a renewal, it was intended to align the idea behind the renewal, the extension, so that the license could be converted to a lease. The new language is on page 7, lines 10 and 11. This just allows the commissioner to extend the lease for the conversion process to occur. And you'll notice, Mr. Chairman, that the language in version A on page 7, lines 21 through 23 is now redundant with this change and has been deleted in the new section.
Sure. It looks like change 9 should say lease conversion, not conversation, I think.
You are correct, sir.
Of course I am.
Very good. That's confident.
I couldn't resist. All right. Rep Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and through you to your aide. I appreciate you citing the page and lines, but it might be nice to have this version of this document with those pages and lines already built in, just for convenience of reference.
Is that typical to do that? Is that standard operating procedure?
It can be, Mr. Chairman.
It can be? Okay.
We can make that happen.
All right. Change, please continue.
Change number 10 is related to the what was called the concurrent storage lease in the original version. It's now called the transition from enhanced oil recovery to storage. This is just clarifying language from the original version that addresses the potential overlap between an oil and gas lease and a carbon storage lease. It also seeks to align the EOR to storage process that was allowed in the AOGCC statutes. I will note, Mr. Chairman, though, that this language is still imperfect, and the committee might consider an amendment to this as well.
Very well. Please continue.
Change number 11 amends the definitions. There are several definitions throughout the bill. They're not all located in the same location. The first is adding a definition of unit agreement. That new language is found on page 11, line 24. The definition of carbon dioxide within Title 38 was removed as it was unnecessary. That was in the version A, page 11, line 29. The terms geologic storage and carbon storage were used interchangeably in the original version of the bill. For clarity, the words or the definition of geologic storage and references to that definition were deleted. Carbon storage is now used throughout the bill. The phrase within the carbon storage definition, perpetual or short term, was potentially causing some confusion, and so was determined to be unnecessary and was deleted. That change was on page 12, line 6, and page 28, line 21. The terms pore space reservoir and supercritical fluid, which are all used in the AOGCC statutes, were not used in the DNR statutes, and the definitions were therefore unnecessary and were deleted. The carbon storage capacity of a storage reservoir was an undefined term in the original version, so a definition was added in this version. And the same is true with the definition of enhanced oil or gas recovery.
Okay, Rep. Sadler.
Just through the chair, Mr. King. So enhanced oil or gas recovery was not included in the AOGCC statutes, but pore space and reservoir were?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Sadler, through the chair, that's correct. The definition did not exist. There are two locations in the bill where there were references to tons, which now are clarified as metric tons. You can find those two changes on page 23, line 27, and page 25, line 26. The section related to the administrative fund was also adjusted a little bit to align with our current appropriation processes in other statutes. That those changes are found on page 23, line 26 through page 24, line 10. On page 25, line 13, DNR was added to the AOGCC requirements that references related to the dismantlement, removal, and restoration of the land. DNR is typically responsible for those obligations, and so just for clarity, we didn't want to give the impression that AOGCC was taking control, so both agencies are now referenced. Change number 15 is the addition of a new section that exempts 45Q credits from the state corporate income tax.
Okay, Rep. McCabe has a question.
Okay, so change 15, there was some concern early on. We spent up half of the meeting on 45Q tax credits. And I guess I'm curious, there was even one proposed amendment out there. I'm curious if this satisfies that amendment, and maybe that's a better question for Rep. Armstrong. Does it? Okay, perfect. Awesome.
Mr. Chairman, I would point out that on this change, the reference in the bill on page 30, the last page of the bill, It is a reference to the tax code 26 U.S.C. 45Q, the actual credits, the application of the credits to the tax liability. There is another reference in chapter 38, which creates the credits. And so the administration had flagged that it was unclear whether the reference should be towards 45Q or towards 38. Our legal team told us that 45 is the correct reference, but there may be a need for further clarity on that issue.
Very well.
And Mr. Chairman, there are a few dozen small technical changes that are made throughout the bill, things like changing upon to onto or changing that to which. These are just drafting changes that were made to conform with other statutes, and they're not substantive.
So to sum up, I think we maybe should ask Mr. Crowther and the DNR. They obviously concur with all the changes that have been made, and we're fully unified at this point.
Chair McKay, John Crowther, Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources. The administration is comfortable with the CS, supports the CS, believes the language is improved. As your aide, Mr. King, shared, there is potentially the possibility to further tweak a few sections for continued improvement, but we support the CS and the committee's review of it as the working document.
Okay, so I was going to announce this later in the talk, but I think maybe I should mention now that we'll accept any amendments to this version S, as in Sam, to my office on or before 5 p.m. on Tuesday, March 7th. And I'll mention that again in my closing, but just so everybody knows, I have a chance to do amendments by 5 p.m. Tuesday, March 7th. So are there any other questions on HB 50 committee substitute? Rep. Sadler.
Very briefly, through the chair, Mr. Crowther, Deputy Commissioner Crowther, change 3, sub 2, condensing the fund to a single account. There seemed to be a pretty reasonable explanation for having the two separate funds. What was the persuasive evidence that we should combine those to a single account?
Representative Sadler, through the chair, I believe I'll let Mr. King speak in the first order and then may supplement.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Rep. Sadler, through the chair. This was a change that was made by the legislative legal lawyers. It had mostly to do with the fact that the dedicated funds clause within our Constitution really puts a damper on the intent of having the two accounts. And so this language that seems to have been borrowed from another state that might not have the dedicated funds prohibition probably made more sense in that context and didn't make sense and created a little bit of confusion with the dedicated funds in our statutes.
Okay.
And that's Ed King for the record.
And just follow up, Mr. King, through the chair. So there's no problems with having that money intermingled? So you have the same fund draw for operations and for long-term liability is going to be okay? There's no sub-fund necessary or any?
Rep. Sadler, through the chair. There is a separate administrative fund that AOGCC puts fees into, like regulatory cost charges, into that for the administration. This closure trust is specifically for expenses that happen post-closure when the state takes title. And so there should not be any such interference or accounting difficulties.
Okay, great. Thanks, sir.
Okay. Okay, Rep. Mears.
Mr. Chair, could you please, if we've got it, our process and timeline for the bill, and if there's plans to include additional public testimony?
Our plan, of course, there's no meeting Friday or Monday, and our plan is to try to move this bill Wednesday, March 8th. And there are no plans for any further public testimony. Okay. Any other questions? All right. I hereby remove my previous objection. Is there further objection to adopting the committee substitute as our working document? Hearing none, version S is now before the committee. And again, as I said before, please submit any amendments to version S to my office before 5 p.m. on Tuesday, March 7th. I will now set HB 50 aside. We'll take a brief at ease to let people reset the room. Thank you. Okay, I call the meeting back to order. House Resources. We will now take up HB 49, Carbon Offset Projects. So we bring HB 49 before the committee. This is our first hearing on HB 49. The goal for today is to gain a high-level understanding of the opportunity the governor has identified for our consideration. The DNR is carrying this bill on behalf of the governor. We have the administration's staff with us today to educate us on this topic. Do I see a Joshua Strauss? No. Joshua?
Yes.
Oh,
yes, I'm present.
I'm so sorry, Mr. Strauss. I didn't realize you were on the TV. I was looking for a real person.
That's right. I assure you I'm a real person, sorry, though I may be zooming in remotely here.
Sorry about that. Okay, so let me introduce you. Joshua Strauss is vice president of ANEW, ANEW. It will be our first testifier. Mr. Strauss, please state your name and affiliation for the record and begin your presentation.
Sure. Yeah, my name is Josh Strauss.
Brief it easy. Okay, we're back on the record. Mr. Strauss, I have to apologize. We're a little bit out of order. Commissioner Boyle wishes to make a few opening comments before your testimony. My apologies.
Sounds good. All good.
Thank you, Chair McKay and members of the committee. It's a pleasure to be in front of you again this afternoon. This is John Boyle, Commissioner Designee for the Department of Natural Resources, for the record. And we're really excited to have this conversation with you today on HB 49, our carbon offsets bill. So as you're all very well aware, we've been spending a fair amount of time in front of this committee lately talking about carbon capture, utilization, and storage. So we've been focusing on the underground portion of the state's resource base for potential carbon sequestration. And now we're pivoting on to utilizing state lands and state submerged lands for the purpose of carbon offsets. And one of the reasons why we at DNR are very excited about this particular opportunity is it, again, offers the state a new avenue from which we can diversify our economy. We can diversify our state revenues through the implementation and development of some of these carbon offset projects. And again, as we've mentioned in the context of CCUS, Alaska has a tremendous competitive advantage versus many other states and jurisdictions that, you know, we benchmark ourselves against, and that we have a tremendous inventory of state lands that may be very well suited for carbon offset projects. And like CCUS, you know, what the administration is asking for is really a broad regulatory framework that enables us to go out and to engage with the market and understand where these carbon offset opportunities exist and where it makes sense for the state to engage itself and be involved in generating these additional revenues to the state. We've just spent in a previous committee a fairly considerable amount of time talking about the state's management of its forests and also the dangers and challenges that the state faces with wildland fire suppression. One of the reasons that we're very excited about the opportunity for carbon offset projects here in the state is that it really helps to incentivize our thinking of how we go about managing state forests. You know, allowing forests to just sort of exist in a state of nature without any kind of intervention or management may not be the ideal for maintaining healthy, robust forests that are not only absorbing, you know, more carbon, but are also more resilient to wildfire. They're also growing higher quality stands of timber that can help enhance and increase our forest products industry, particularly in areas in interior Alaska where historically we've had a fairly limited amount of economic activity despite the fact that we have millions upon millions of acres of forested lands. So the prospect of carbon offsets is really can be looked at as an economic sweetener that may help incentivize companies to come in, manage state forested land, harvest timber, while at the same time, you know, implementing more aggressive management techniques to allow certain tracts of forest to absorb more carbon and meet some of these additionality requirements that many of these carbon projects and registries have. And you know, we'll have our technical folks will come in and talk more about the nuts and bolts of that. But from a high-level you know, we see this as an opportunity to really revitalize the forest industry here in Alaska. And I think it could create a lot of exciting opportunities, not only in that industry, but just in terms of, you know, people interested in pursuing careers in forestry in general. I also think it's important to highlight what this bill isn't. You know, this bill is not creating new conservation areas within the state. This bill is not implementing carbon taxes or some cap and trade regime on businesses or industries operating within the state. Lands that are set aside or you know, utilized for carbon development projects are going to be lands that Alaskans are still able to hunt and fish and camp and build roads and be able to do all of the things that we enjoy doing in our public lands. You know, these aren't areas that are going to be managed like small national parks or you know, areas that are going to be off limits to riding ATVs or snow machines or things like that. So it's important to highlight that we can do these projects and manage forests in a way that is still reflective of the state's, you know, ethos of making sure that all uses, you know, can continue to occur on state lands and that, you know, our people have access to their state lands to utilize them in ways that help enrich the lives of all Alaskans. So we're really excited about this opportunity. We think that there is tremendous financial upside to the state with pursuing some of these projects. We've seen, you know, our Alaska Native corporations take the lead in this effort some years ago by you know, engaging in some of these carbon markets and utilizing some of their private lands and putting them forth in regulated carbon offset markets. We're very excited about the opportunities in voluntary carbon markets and the opportunity, again, that the state can use to monetize its resources in ways to help diversify our state revenue stream. And I'd also like to point out that in addition to the state forested lands that we have that are such a tremendous asset to the state also has, you know, some 30,000 miles of coastline and submerged lands that are, many of which are very high quality areas where carbon offset projects like commercial kelp farms and the like could be implemented that could also revitalize and provide further opportunities in the mariculture industry for Alaskans. And, you know, they can grow kelp, they can absorb carbon, and that carbon can be sequestered as well and provide some revenue streams to the state and to those private entities involved in those efforts. So, you know, we see a tremendous amount of opportunity. It's important to note, I think, that this market is still nascent. It's still evolving. You know, the state needs to be nimble and flexible to see, you know, how things go, how things progress. But, you know, all signs point that this market will continue to grow, that there will be more opportunities. And there may be other interesting kind of carbon offset projects, carbon related projects, I should say, that we haven't really, you know, considered yet or that really may not be fully developed, like utilizing tundra for carbon storage, intact ecosystems, other kind of opportunities. You know, really the state wants to see, you know, how this market progresses and it advances and really, you know, identify areas where it might make sense for the state to participate in this to help, you know, grow our state economy. So with those high-level remarks, I will gladly now turn it over to some of the folks that can actually put more meat on the bones.
Okay, thank you, Commissioner Designee Boyle, for your remarks. We appreciate you being here. And now I will turn to Mr. Joshua Strauss, Senior Vice President of ANU, our first testifier. Apologize for the schedule glitch, Mr. Strauss, so please state your name and your affiliation for the record and begin your presentation.
Yeah, no problem at all. My name is Josh Strauss. I'm a senior vice president from ANU. As I mentioned briefly before, we're the organization that actually worked with the DNR to put together what has been referred to, I think, in several other hearings as the ANU report, really looking at potential for carbon credit generation on DNR land and really honing in on forest land and the forest carbon opportunity. I will say that Commissioner Designee Boyle's statements leading up to this kind of oriented things well. So I'm glad that set the stage in a way so we're not just jumping in cold. But, you know, he talked about a number of different ways that carbon could be beneficial to the state of Alaska. And what I really want to focus on here is specifically talking about the forest carbon opportunity. With that, I'll just kind of jump into my slide deck, if you all don't mind. What I'll go through today is just talk a little bit about my organization. Then I'm going to talk about the difference between compliance and voluntary carbon markets. Then we'll kind of get into a bit of the nitty gritty of what are the components of a quality carbon offset. I'll talk briefly about the findings from our report and our investigation into some pilot project potential for Alaskan forests, particularly DNR managed forests. And then I'll talk about the actual project development process and how that all pulls together. And then, you know, I'll be happy to take questions at the end. But as I've experienced in previous discussions with on this topic, if folks have a burning question, I'm happy to answer that in real time. So you can feel free. So a little bit about Anu and myself. As I mentioned, I'm a senior vice president with the organization. I've actually been with Anu for over a decade right now. My career has been completely based in carbon and forestry. My background is in forestry. I have a master's in forestry and a master's of environmental management focused on carbon economics. My organization, Anu, is the oldest operating carbon offset developer in North America. We have the largest portfolio of offset tons that are in existence on the continent. We really have the premier development team for forest carbon offsets in both the voluntary and the compliance space, with over 110 different projects under management and over 5 million acres incorporated in that, you know, consideration of forest for carbon use and carbon credit development. The team that I manage has over 30 people, all of which have at least a master's in forestry. So want to show you here just an image of some of those 110 projects and just where they fall across the U.S. and Canadian landscape. Kind of important to note here, there's a variety of different types of landowners who engage in these projects, one of which being public ownerships, right? So there's privates, there's for-profits, there's not-for-profits, there are tribal organizations, but there's also state and county lands as well. There's a call-out box where you'll see we've done quite a bit of work in Alaska with Native tribal corporations. We have 6 operational projects right now in the state of Alaska. Mentioned public entities. I think that it's important to understand that though what the DNR in Alaska is considering is still, as was mentioned, it's a nascent industry, and they would be one of the earlier movers in this space. It's definitely not the first to step forward and see if these projects can really work in that context. We have 2 successful projects with the Michigan DNR. We're currently working with the Ohio DNR as well. There are 8 different counties in Wisconsin engaged in these projects. We also work with public universities, townships, etc. So there have been quite a few examples of successful projects that have moved forward, and I've been, you know, proud to be associated with many of those. And uniquely, our organization is the only one that's worked with state level organizations. So enough about the organization myself. Now I just want to move into some of the meat of the discussion and, you know, some of the basics of forest carbon. So to start off at the very basic, and I won't belabor this too much. At the very, you know, core level, what happens when you generate a carbon offset from forestry? The idea is that as trees grow, they photosynthesize, they pull carbon out of the atmosphere that bonds. They will pull that and they will convert that into their wood material, thereby capturing and sequestering the carbon for a long-term period, as long as that tree is standing and intact. One way that increased carbon can be sequestered is if trees that would otherwise be cut down are encouraged to stay standing or new trees are planted. So that's the underlying rationale for generating carbon offsets from forests, and the reason why a forest management organization, a whether that be a DNR or an individual or a nonprofit, et cetera, would choose to adjust their forest management or make long-term forest management commitments associated with carbon sequestration would be because organizations that want to reduce their own emissions will pay them to do so, and they pay them for the carbon credits associated with those emissions reductions represented through the forest management activity. So when you think about who's buying these things, right, and what context does that occur? Well, there's two primary programs. There is one that is the voluntary program, and that is just like it sounds. Folks who participate have no legal mandate to do so. They voluntarily choose to purchase carbon offsets to help reduce their emissions. Now, typically, at this point, right, so this market has been growing fairly rapidly in the last 2-3 years, because as we've seen greater and greater acceptance of the reality of climate change, large corporates, you know, we're talking about, you know, all throughout the domestic and international sector have had significant pressure both internally and externally to try and address their carbon footprint. Now, generally what they do is they try and reduce as many emissions as they can internally within their processes. But then once they have basically exhausted all the available avenues they have to reduce their own emissions through more effective shipping processes or better energy efficiency, et cetera, then they move into purchasing offsets. So paying folks outside of their business to make adjustments that will lead to emissions reductions, right? And forestry is a very significant one of those methods. So in the voluntary space, you see quite a bit of variation in pricing in these credits. You see here on my slide, I say $4 to $35 generally in the U.S. and Canada. The reason why you see that is because these are not purely a fungible unit, though technically all carbon credits should equal 1 metric ton of carbon dioxide emissions reductions. They are not all created equal. There are a number of different programs under which they are calculated and issued. Those programs have various levels of integrity. Those programs have various levels of market acceptance. And because of that, buyers are willing to pay quite a different sum for the different projects. Also, and this is an important piece, though buyers may be paying for 1 ton of emissions reductions, they also are keen on what are the other aspects of the project that they may be helping to fund by purchasing the carbon ton. Now, when you're thinking about a forest, that's when you can really introduce what I like to call the sort of charisma of a carbon project or of a carbon credit. Because though I as a buyer may be saying, yes, I will count this carbon credit towards my emissions profile, what I'm also doing is protecting water quality, protecting air quality, providing habitat, providing opportunities for recreation, potentially avoiding erosion. So all these other less quantified components, but that are fundamentally tied to the action of increasing forest stocking or maintaining forest stocking, that can really help add to the price. And that's what we see in the forest realm compared to, say, a landfill gas credit, where people are less enthusiastic about the co-benefits of flaring methane coming off a landfill. Not to say that climate-wise, same exact thing, right? These are equivalent in terms of the climate impact, but there are those ancillary benefits that buyers can get enthusiastic about, and that certainly is a benefit to forest carbon considerations.
Okay, now, Mr. Strauss, yes. If I could just stop you for a second. We got a couple questions. Representative Rauscher.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Strauss. Appreciate the presentation. Thank you. Through the chair, I was just wondering, since we're talking about a voluntary market here and a compliance market, and in the compliance market, I see it's kind of like, it looks like it's state statute driven. Is there anything federal on the horizon that's going to come our way that's in the near future that we don't understand or don't know about? Do you know anything about that?
There is nothing that is currently on the horizon for a federal program. In the decade that I've been working in this field, and then the multiple decades that I've been really, you know, following it, there has been, you know, significant efforts to try and move forward a federal program. They've all fallen short, and right now there's nothing even on the horizon that looks like it is going to be a viable path. So what I think, and that's one of the reasons I'd say that you've seen such a flourishing in the voluntary market, because so many of the organizations have been sitting on the fence saying, I don't want to commit to doing anything voluntarily, but I think the feds are going to regulate against me. But becoming fairly clear that that isn't happening, you're seeing many of these large corporates saying, all right, now I'm going to make my commitment to the broader world, and I'm going to be held accountable by my stakeholders and shareholders as opposed to the feds. And that's why you're seeing what we're calling like net zero commitments for reaching zero emissions profile by 2030 or 2050 by a lot of the world's biggest corporations.
Okay, follow up, please.
Yeah, I appreciate it. So then basically what we're saying is if there is going to be any kind of a compliance program, we'd have to come through the Capitol building here ourselves. Is that what you're saying?
I would say if there's going to be a compliance program, it very likely would have to, right? There's no federal oversight that is on the horizon. And the only compliance programs that are, you know, actually total economy-wide for different states right now are located in California and Washington. There's been considerable consideration in Oregon. And there's a community of states that have a limited compliance program in the northeastern U.S. called REGI, but it is not as – it doesn't encompass the – it's energy only as opposed to all of the economy of those states. So that's a little bit more context, but to be direct to your question, I would say yes, it would have to come through Alaska, through the state.
I appreciate the question. Thank you.
Okay, Rep. Mears has a question.
Thank you. I'm taken by this phrase, charismatic projects. I would imagine that we're in the scenario, since these are voluntary compliance, there's a company looking to purchase carbon credits. They look through their book of options and they say, preserving habitat for wolverines and lynx in Alaska. That's a charismatic that's a project I want to invest in. Is that what we're talking about here?
That's precisely what I'm talking about. And because of that, you can see, all right, well, I'm also protecting lynx habitat. Maybe instead of this credit being worth $20 to me, it's worth $27, right? And the reason you get pricing like that is because it's like any marketplace, you know, there's competition for limited credits. And when you have a unique product, though it may still have that one ton of emissions reductions that they get to count on their balance sheet of carbon, you know, if I'm an organization that wants to show that I'm doing good by the environment while at the same time reducing emissions, certainly seems appealing.
Okay. Rep. Sadler has a question.
Thank you. Through the chair, Mr. Joshua, Mr. last name? Strauss. Mr. Strauss. Thank you, sir. yeah, I was also taken by the term charismatic. I mentally substituted vanity for that. If there's not a real hard, fast value to it in terms of the actual metric tons of carbon sequestered, and it's more about the halo effect you might get from making this investment, does that tend to undercut the reliability of the markets? I mean, you do say there's less certain demand. This is a kind of, I guess this is an observation as much as a question, is this kind of charismatic project is not something you would want to count on because public attitudes may change and saving the planet might not have the value of the marketplace in 20 years that it does today. But so the question I'll ask is, how much of the carbon market is voluntary versus compliance? You may get to that, but I just thought I'd ask now.
Sure. No, it makes total sense. And I would say that your concerns about saying, you know, what is the guarantee or how do we know that that is the thing about the voluntary market. There is no regulatory mandate, but there is something that is close to it, right? The idea that we have companies that have made very public statements and commitments saying that by 2030, I am going to be carbon neutral and I'm going to get there by using offsets or by 2050. Now, once you make those statements, you have shareholders to report to, and you have your larger constituency of customers that are going to hold you accountable. Now, that could be to more or less of a degree, but at the same time, these companies take it very seriously, and the amount of egg on their face if they were to renege on these commitments at this point, particularly with gaining concern over the climate issue, seems to outweigh the likelihood that they would want to on a whim, you know, abandon some of those commitments. I will say that, yes, the pricing is variable based on these other less quantifiable aspects, but there are active measures being taken right now to try and add quantification to all sorts of different components of a carbon project. And by enrolling in one now, that wouldn't preclude your ability to try and better quantify some of the other positive impacts of the project as those methodologies get fleshed out. And that's something that my team and I are actively involved in. There's something called SDGs or Sustainable Development Goals that have, you know, various different kind of focuses, some that are on habitat, some that are on water quality. And if you can find, if the registries and the programs that design these rule sets can help us, you know, find acceptable and peer-reviewed ways to quantify those, we're going to add those pieces into the total calculus. So, you know, don't want to get too far in the weeds here, but it's something that's being thought about and something that can be readily incorporated into projects that, we would hope to be moving forward with in the meantime. Now, to the compliance piece. So
he's got a follow-up. Rip Sadler has a follow-up. Okay. Mr. Strauss, sorry.
For the record, sure. I don't want to say I'm against the price mechanism. If Alaska can derive benefit from the charismatic projects, as Representative Muir says, I'm all for pocketing that money.
Yeah.
Okay. Mr. Strauss, I don't mean to slow you up because I do want you to get through this. I do have one question. As you probably know, we just finished discussing HB 50, which is the carbon storage bill. And in that bill, there were federal tax credits awarded for injecting CO2 in below ground reservoirs. So I'm just trying to draw distinctions here for the benefit of the committee and the public. Is there any federal tax credits on the voluntary side of this for doing carbon credits? I don't believe there are, but I want you to correct me if I'm wrong.
I can confirm that right now there's not a direct path to federal tax credits for these activities.
Okay, and I also wish to point out for the benefit of the audience and the public that our House Bill 49 just addresses the voluntary market. Okay, please, Rep. Dibert, please.
Thank you, Mr. Strauss, through the chair. I have a quick question. We just had a presentation by the Forest about forest fires. And if we have companies who, you know, want land in Alaska and in the interior, we have a lot. We have forest fires. Is that, how do you address forest fires in wooded areas in the interior of Alaska?
If they're in the program,
It's an excellent question. Being a developer and manager of six different carbon projects in Alaska, we're keenly aware of the forest fire risk. That is a question that I definitely was going to address later in the presentation, but I want to address it right now just so folks can tick that box in their mind. The way that a high quality carbon program works, and what my company has proposed and what we generally think is the best fit for Alaska from the forestry setting is moving forward with the American Carbon Registry's voluntary improved forest management protocol. And within that, there is something called a buffer, which is basically an insurance pool for a pooled insurance mechanism for all different projects that are enrolled throughout the program. You know, so if you are in Maine or if you are in California or if you are in Washington, each project that generates credits is going to put in approximately 20% of the total issuance that they could have received into this insurance pool to cover off against catastrophic loss. So you could think of it kind of like homeowner's insurance, where you're going to pay in your premium on a regular basis. If nothing goes wrong, you don't get anything back, but if it does, you're covered and you're not stuck with a situation where you've claimed a bunch of reductions in emissions that have now literally gone up in smoke. And the way that percentage of how many credits you have to put in your insurance premium, if you will, is based on a number of factors that we calculate based on your risk, right? So areas that have higher pest risk may have a bit higher rating where they have to put in more into the insurance pool. Areas with fire may, but then other things may lead to reductions. And very specifically, there are ways to reduce the need to buy greater amounts of this insurance or put greater amounts of credits into the insurance pool by taking active measures to reduce fire risk. For example, doing treatments to reduce to reduce fuels, doing treatments to provide fire breaks, etc. And that's something that we advise all our clients on as they think about projects.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Strauss. Let's continue here so we can We have about 25 minutes left, and I certainly want you to try to get through your slides.
Oh, well, if I only have 5 minutes left, I'm going to...
No, 25.
Okay. All right, I can do that. So I will just quickly wrap with the compliance market. In terms of total value created at this point, the compliance market had for a long time been the central major marketplace, but just as I've mentioned in the last 2 years, voluntary has really, really grown. The compliance market is for forestry is basically entirely in California and its connection to Quebec right now through the Western Climate Initiative. There is projection that Washington will have substantial or meaningful appetite for forest credits moving forward, though that isn't an active offset program yet. There are also some other ones on the horizon. Increasingly, the Canadian federal and provincial programs seem like there's going to be a real meaningful appetite there too. But those credits, as I was saying, they consistently trade at more regular pricing. These are relatively fungible units. People don't care as much about the charisma. People don't really care about the other attributes. It's simply we're buying a reduction in emissions that I can count towards my total that I can then, the regulator will accept. So two different spaces. When you think about who's buying the credits in the voluntary space, it's really every organization in the Fortune 500, all the major international corporates. Here's just some basic examples of organizations that we've worked with. You can see there's the banking sector in here, the technology sector in here, the food production, automotive, et cetera, et cetera. So really, energy, you name it, these large organizations are engaged. Now, I know that anybody who's thinking about a project, the first thing, once you decide that this is a real thing and there might be a real opportunity financially, is, well, what am I actually committing to and giving up? And what I wanted to outline here, and I'll focus on the voluntary obligations because just as a sort of overarching concept here, like the state's lands are not readily eligible to participate in the compliance programs right now, based on the way that they are designed, there would not be viable projects. So we can narrow our vision right now to say, okay, the voluntary marketplace is where we're going to be participating if we so choose. And there's some real advantages in terms of the length of the voluntary commitment as well. It's one thing I would note is at the bottom of this table, when I say the monitoring period, the full obligation for any acre that's included into these programs in the voluntary setting under the ACR or American Carbon Registry, as I mentioned earlier, is a 40-year commitment, so four full decades. Under the compliance program, it can be well over 100 years, depending on how long the particular project generates credits. So that is something to keep in mind that is a benefit in the view of many landowners in terms of having more flexibility, given that it's only a four-decade commitment compared to a much longer time frame. But it's a meaningful commitment at that, right? So you may have that timeline, but here's what it entails. So, A, if you have a forest and you enroll, the key thing you should be thinking about is that over time, you're going to be either maintaining or increasing carbon across your landscape. That's what's going on. If you're not increasing or maintaining carbon, if it's going down, then you're not creating a climate benefit in that context. So that's a fundamental. Now, there is a sort of an ancillary thing that's required is anything that enrolls in these programs usually needs to have certification, if you're going to be doing commercial harvesting by, FSC, SFI, or tree farm. Now, the exception in that is if you have a state-approved management plan, which, of course, the DNR will, so that box is ticked automatically in the context of Alaska. So what comes next? Well, so we know we're going to be quantifying the amount of carbon that's in the forest. We're going to be quantifying how much is growing over time. But what we need to do to get that quantification done is really carry out an inventory. So there's a requirement that a detailed forest carbon inventory is put in place across the project area. And is revisited on a decadal basis. So you will, and I'll talk more about this later in the sort of nuance of the inventory, but you're going to be gathering data on the ground, and that data will be recollected on a decadal basis to make sure it's kept up to date. All of these calculations, all of the measurements in the field, all the quantification will need to be approved by a third-party verification body.
So the idea being is that just because someone goes out and calculates carbon by a rule set and says, we've done a great job, here we go, here's our package, here's what we present to the registry as our total emissions reductions, that isn't going to be enough to get the credit. You have to go through a very rigorous third-party verification, and that is done by professional verification bodies that have approval by within the designated registry programs and by ANSI. Those verifications at a minimum have to happen every 5 years, but can happen as frequently as once a year if a project chose to undergo them on a more regular basis. And you would do that because you can only issue credits when you undergo verification. So generally, ANUS projects undergo verification on an annual basis, thereby creating new opportunities to generate credits every year. And then reporting, you need to track how much material is removed in terms of commercial harvesting on an annual basis. And you need to, based on the documentation modeling that was put in the project design, you need to track the accrual of carbon across that landscape. So annually you're going to be submitting some monitoring documentation to the program, to the registry. And I can get a little bit more into those components, but broadly that is the framework which a project owner commits to. I will say, just to kind of dot the I, because I know this was touched on in the initial presentation before I began, but the commitment to a carbon forest program does not prevent folks from utilizing that land for recreation. It doesn't in any way prevent ATV use. Doesn't prevent snow machine use. It does not prevent the utilization of subsurface minerals. So should the state decide that they had a mineral interest below an active forest carbon project, there's no reason that those minerals could not be utilized. And I think that there's a misconception sometimes that that's the case. The idea is that you just keep track of how much carbon is represented in the tree material. And if you have to harvest a bunch of trees in order to access those minerals, well, you account for that. But other than that, there's no prohibition. So I want to make sure folks understand that they do not write off a whole lot of flexibility with their land management by participating. And also, as was mentioned before, this is not about hermetically sealing forest. Of our 110-ish projects, I would say almost 90% have active commercial forest management on the project area. This is about being conscientious about carbon in your forest management, taking action to reduce harvest in areas that would, you know, contribute to greater emissions, and also trying to extend rotations to perhaps capture more carbon in long-lived wood products, and really thinking holistically about management that would encourage greater growth to capture carbon moving forward, right? So this is about active management for carbon.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Strauss. Gotta take a breath. You need to take a sip of water. You're going really fast.
Hey, so I'm happy to go slower. I was just conscientious of the conscious of the fact that we have a limited time.
We always try to balance questions and curiosities with time. I have a question here. This is Chairman McKay, and for the record, Joshua Strauss is answering these questions. The 40-year and the 100-year in that table at the bottom, it's called a monitoring period. And a two-part question, what exactly does that mean? Does that mean like a 40-year lease under the voluntary and a 100-year lease under the compliance? And the second part of my question is, I understand that the native corporations in Alaska, which appear on your map previously here in the presentation, have participated in the California program, which is a compliance cap and trade program, and I understand 22% of the California forests that have been tied up under the compliance program are in Alaska. Does that mean that those properties are under lease for 100 years? Seems like a very long time. Maybe you could explain that.
Sure. I'll start with the first question. So the first question is, what is the monitoring period? And the monitoring period is the amount of time which the landowner is obligated to follow the rules of the program. Namely, they have to maintain their carbon across their landscape that was there when they started the project, and that in the volume that is there each time they claim credits. So as your forest grows and you continue to claim credits on that forest, you have to commit to keeping that level of stocking consistent for the life of the project. In the case of the voluntary space, it's a 40-year flat commitment. You have 40 years, and during that period, you maintain your stocking or increase it, and you verify every 5 years, you update your inventory every 10, and you annually report on harvesting. Okay? Now, in the compliance world, it's different in terms of length. So you have 100 years of monitoring that are required out of after the last issuance of carbon credits. Now, you can issue carbon credits for up to 100 years. So if you issue, say, credits for 20 years, then you have 100 more years of monitoring, so your full project length would be 120 years. And so that's why I put the plus next to it, because however long you issue credits, you're going to have another 100-year tail in terms of monitoring. And that monitoring is going to consist of 6-year verifications, 12-year inventories, annual reporting, and of course, the, as I mentioned, the sort of golden rule of not letting your stocking drop below the level at which your credits were last issued. This is not about leasing land. This is about a commitment to a program, one being, in the compliance context, a commitment to the state of California, and in the voluntary context, a commitment to the, as I'm in the category that I've been discussing here, the American Carbon Registry, which is a voluntary registry that serializes credits, develops the protocols, and manages the broader trading and retirement of the units when they're generated.
So, to reiterate my question, the native corporations that have sold credits in Alaska so far, they're under the compliance program, which is the 100-year situation.
Some of them are. We have developed 4 voluntary projects with native corporations in Alaska. So, there have been more in the compliance than the voluntary, but there is active voluntary participation. I guess my organization is the only one that has had credits that have been fully developed and sold, but those are 4 very successful projects. And there's no reason that that protocol wouldn't be readily utilizable by the state. Now, in terms of the commitments that were associated with the native corporations in the voluntary and in the compliance, they fall in line with what I had just described. You know, so the voluntary ones have that 40-year timeline, and the compliance ones have that 100-plus.
Okay, I hate to do this, but we're going to have to keep going, or we're not going to finish Mr. Strauss by 3 o'clock, and I would hate to have to bring him back. But can you please continue then, Mr. Strauss?
Absolutely. So I want to talk about sort of the idea of quality, like what makes a quality carbon offset. And this is one of the reasons why you see variation in the pricing in the voluntary space, because not all credits are designed to the same standards. Now, the good news is that there are some very well-established bodies that have long history of integrity and that are managed by very qualified and experienced individuals. And generally, the bodies that develop these standards are nonprofits, so the motive is clear that it's that their raison d'etre, their reason for doing what they're doing is emissions reductions. But when you think about principles of quality, you want a project that ticks these various boxes. And the one that you hear most right now, and there's arguably the most important piece, is this idea of additionality. Additionality meaning, in the absence of carbon incentives, would the same emissions reductions be taking place anyway? So if nothing is going to change in terms of the way that carbon is sequestered and maintained across the landscape during the projected project period, then you should not be getting credits for it. And that's fundamental. So we only develop projects where we can say, look, here's a difference in outcomes compared to without carbon revenue and with carbon revenue. Permanence is really an idea of length. So in the case of the voluntary market we're talking about, it's a 40-year period of permanence. In the compliance, it's 100 plus. Now, there are some programs that only require a single year, right? So you're talking about, you know, what is the total commitment time? And you want to make sure there's a meaningful amount of time that's associated with that in order to generate really higher value from your buyers. Verification monitoring, you want to have qualified, non-biased third-party bodies that are going to be doing the verification work to confirm that the calculations, modeling, et cetera, that's done by the project developer are accurate and justified. Serialization and registration, I was talking about those bodies, the registries that maintain these programs, create the rule sets or methodologies for generating carbon, track, serialize the offset units, allow for them to be traded, sold, and retired, and for each unit to only be used a single time, thereby, you know, maintaining the integrity of the program. That's important. I list here the CAR, ACR, VCS, and ARB programs are all highly respected, notable programs in the space. The concept of leakage. Any good program should also keep track of this idea that in the forest context, if you're going to be reducing the harvesting that you are undertaking, then there very well may be an increase in harvesting somewhere else to try and fill the market demand for the product that you're no longer producing. And so all the high rigor programs should have mechanisms for calculating, you know, what is the likelihood of some of the reductions that pop up in one place leading to increased harvesting in another. Generally, the way to best address this is through being as conservative as reasonable. In the ACR program that we generally use, it's often a 40% reduction in total crediting is associated with leakage. So you, right off the bat, before you get to take credit for anything, take a 40% hit to say, look, conservatively, we're going to assume, based on a bunch of research that has gone into getting these figures, that 40% is going to go up, is going to be taken elsewhere for market demand. So that's an important piece to keep taking into account. Maintaining a close eye for reversals, that's the loss of credits, the loss of carbon stocking over the landscape. That can happen both intentionally, that's a bad actor who chooses to harvest beyond the level at which their commitment would allow, or unintentional, that's the sort of fire or pest situation that we talked about before, but making sure we keep a very clear eye on how the carbon stocks are performing over time. And then the last piece, the insurance of the buffer pool, is there a solid buffer in place that if you do have an unintended natural loss of credits, the fire example, the windstorm, snowstorm, et cetera, that there is this ample insurance pool that can replace the lost credits and thereby keep the system whole. Want to talk very briefly about some of the work that we did in our analysis for the DNR. We really tried to look at three different focus areas within the DNR's holding. We were looking at Haynes in Southeast Alaska. We were looking at Tananon. We were looking at Matsu and trying to say, okay, within these large acreage holdings, we did a mixture of a remote sensing analysis plus analysis of data that the DNR had on hand from groundwork, plus looking into various timber markets and infrastructure, and ran some numbers on what we think are reasonable potential credit generation scenarios. Key things we were looking at in this are, what is the stocking in these areas? Where are the products that could be produced? You know, what are the species that are there? What do the markets look like for those various species? How is the access to the material? What is the infrastructure like for processing that material? All those components come into play. And what we basically found was that we think that there are some pretty solid opportunities at this pilot phase that would be very interesting to pursue. And you know, after that, this is far from the extent of the opportunity within the state. But just in these pilots alone, we're talking about in 10 years, about $80 million of revenue at our currently anticipated pricing for the state, you know, in this pilot sort of segment. And I would say that, you know, over the 40-year life, considerably more given where we expect pricing to be moving. One thing I would note is that though Alaska has vast, vast forest resources, not all of those acres are going to be eligible. You know, part of what I was talking about in the aspects of quality in the previous slide is, can we meet those additionality standards? Is something that we're doing actually going to sequester greater carbon than would have otherwise been accumulate on the landscape in the absence of the project? So that's always got to weigh heavily into our thinking as we develop these.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Strauss. We have some questions, and I've been advised we can go a little bit past 3. But I know what it's like to sit in a meeting for two solid hours, so I certainly don't want to push that very far. Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Through the chair, Mr. Strauss. So just real briefly, at a high level, additionality means that the trees were going to be cut anyway, right?
Additionality means that you look at your project term, right? So in this case, 40 years. And you're going to compare what you are going to do in this project scenario to an alternate hypothetical scenario or a baseline. In this case, what we'll do to develop a baseline is we'll say for these particular acres, given the allowable cut in the current management plan, what would be a financially advantageous harvest scenario if you didn't think about carbon at all, right? We're just, so carbon's out the window. What is going to be the best net present value approach to harvesting over these next 40 years, given the asset and given the markets, given the products that can be developed, right? Yeah. And then so we build a hypothetical scenario. And then we compare that to what you're actually going to do now that the carbon project is in place. So on an annual basis, however much less you cut than you would have in that hypothetical that is verified by that is verified and approved, that delta is what generates the credit.
Okay.
I didn't understand that. So help me. So without all the hypothetical, so I just want to understand, additionality means the trees were going to be cut anyway. What's the baseline? Please keep it simple.
Okay. So the baseline scenario is what is likely or very possible, plausible in the absence of a carbon project. Great. So a management strategy that leads to one carbon outcome.
Great. Thank
okay.
You.
And the project scenario is an alternative. And the difference in total stocking between the two, that's how many carbon credits you generate.
Okay. Rep. Mears has a question.
Thank you. It also looks like we've only got 5 minutes left on our Zoom. So I'm gleaning here that we're talking about a 40-year life, so we're only talking about the voluntary market here and not the compliance market. I think I picked up quickly earlier that the state projects wouldn't be eligible for the compliance market. I'd like a little more explanation about why that is and if there's a difference in market rates between the voluntary and compliance markets.
HB 49 just covers the voluntary market. Commissioner Boyle or Mr. Crowther, would you like to maybe second that?
Chair McKay, for the record, this is John Crowther, Deputy Commissioner. So it's our understanding that under current protocols for those compliance markets, public lands in Alaska would not be eligible. And so that's why we're targeting the voluntary market with HB 49.
Okay. Clear?
Right. So the second part of that, is there a market difference when we're looking at selling these credits? Is there a difference between what we would get on a voluntary market versus a compliance?
Yeah. And my projections that I had in an earlier slide were showing basically the difference in pricing. And compliance credits are generally trading for around $18 right now. The voluntary space, as I mentioned, there's a larger window, but for this particular product, for a forest credit from Alaska, it will be trading at, we predict to trade around $16 to $26, $27. So we're talking about high likelihood of being at par or higher with the compliance.
Okay.
That's enough for now. Thanks.
Okay, all right. Please continue. Try to finish up, Mr. Strauss, in a couple minutes.
Yeah.
Thanks.
I've got two slides. So really quickly, I just want to talk about the development process, like what goes into making this happen, because it's a scientifically rigorous process, and I want people to understand that there's not just hand-waving going on here. There's deep research that ends up panning out in terms of credit generation. So what typically happens when a developer like Anew engages in one of these projects is we go through a sort of a seven-step cycle. First one is a feasibility analysis. So you look at available data, both remote, you know, so using satellite data, using whatever is available in that case, plus whatever on-the-ground information you have. In the case of the DNR, we have a fairly rich data set to work with to figure out, does it look like there's something that's actually viable there to bring a project forward? Once you get past that point, you list the project So you contract with the landowner, in this case, the state of Alaska. You list the project, so formally designate with the registry, with that platform that's going to allow for the credits to be traded and sold, that the project is moving forward and under which methodology, under which protocol. And then you move into the collection of your forest carbon inventory, which is, when you think about this kind of data collection, it's similar to a sort of academic level of rigor as opposed to a typical timber inventory. What we'll be doing is establishing a network of permanent inventory plots across a grid over the entirety of the project area. And each one of those plots is going to have monumentation so that it can be revisited consistently over the life of the project, so we can track down to the individual tree how they're growing and how they are being affected over time. On each of these plots, we're going to be collecting data such as the diameter of the tree to the nearest tenth of an inch, the height of the tree to the nearest foot. We're going to look for defect in the trees, missing material that would equate to missing carbon. We'll track dead trees. We'll track the level of decay on dead trees. We'll have sapling plots to check growth. We'll take tree cores to understand what the site index or the quality of the soils and the potential for growth on those various sites. And so that is done at this elaborate network across the plot, across the property. And once we aggregate that data, then we can say with a high level of certainty what the total carbon picture looks like for stocking across the project area. Once we have that data in hand, we move into the modeling and the documentation stage. So we fill out all the required documentation per the methodology. We model the carbon growth over time as well as the baseline over time. And then once that package is completed, we can hire a third-party verifier to review our models, review the documentation, and actually go into the field and audit the data collection, right? So that they make sure that the data that's going in to these calculations is consistent to what's actually out in the woods. Once the verifier gets comfortable with the documentation, and it usually involves a series of findings and back and forth discussion and kicking up the tires of the entire process, they will approve the project, at which point it is then passed on to the registry, where the registry will do their own audit, will confirm that the verifier did things correctly, will confirm that they are in agreement with the carbon quantification, and then they will issue credits to the project owner. In that, when I say issue, each of those tons of carbon dioxide equivalent, each offset, will be given a unique serial number so that it can be traded, sold, and only once, and retired once, when a buyer desires to use that to account for their own emissions reductions.
Okay, Mr. Strauss, I have to ask you, in listening to that scope of work, it sounds like a very expensive exercise to send people out into the woods to measure trees to the nearest foot and the nearest tenth of an inch, to look at the soils, to do all this work, reports, verification. How much does all that cost, and who is going to pay for that?
It's an excellent question. And the way that different businesses have different models. I can speak for the way that my organization does it. So the way ANU does this is that we cover all the costs associated with project development. And, you know, we can be talking in the millions of dollars, and we are only reimbursed upon successful sale of the credits, right? So we consider ourselves, we're a turnkey operator, right? We work with landowners as partners. We're not a contractor. We don't get any fee for service. The idea is that we're going to develop all these credits. We're going to pay for the inventory. We're going to pay for every aspect. And then when we go and actually sell them, we will get reimbursed out of the proceeds, and we will share in the total revenue with the landowner. And that's the model we've used for our 20 plus years of existence. The idea being is that everyone's incentives are aligned, and our percentage share will be much smaller than the landowner's share. Now, the percentage will vary depending on the size of the project, complexity of the project, et cetera. But for any large scale project, we're going to be taking less than 25%. And sometimes in the single percent digits, depending on the size, of the total revenue generated. But either way, everyone's incentives are aligned. And if for some reason we were unsuccessful in getting the project verified and signing the credits, then we would walk with the loss. So we have 100% skin in the game. And that generally has been quite appealing to public landowners who don't have to allocate, public funds to getting these projects up and running. And I think that's why we have been successful in working with so many other public organizations because it's a risk-free opportunity.
Okay, how about your last slide, Mr. Strauss? Sorry to be I'm the biggest violator of the delay.
No, that's fine. So I just wanted to I'll go through this one, not line by line. I'm just going to say this gives you a little bit of an idea of what that timeline is to go from committing to starting a project and listing with a registry to actually getting credits issued. The most, efficient pattern is kind of an 18-month from when you start to when credits are issued. Much, much more common to be closer to 24 months. Because there's certain things that, as much as we can be as efficient as possible with doing the calculations and submitting the documents, ultimately you got to deal with how does the weather allow you to get the data? How does the weather allow the verifiers to come out to get the data? What's happening at the, in terms of the registry staff's availability to review? Whatever, though, we're saying about 18 months to 2 years, that's how long it takes to go from we're pressing start to when you have your first issuance and when you can have those credits sold and first revenue recognized by the landowner.
Okay.
And with that, I would go to questions.
I'll ask for any burning questions, but make sure they're burning. Rep. Sadler?
What the hell? You mentioned, Mr. Strauss, an offset. What is an offset? Is that the 1 million tons of, is that a one carbon credit?
Yes, and thank you for asking. It's the offset is the same as credit, is the same as one metric ton of emissions reduction.
Great.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Strauss, very, very much. We appreciate your knowledge on this greatly, and thank you for your patience as we ask our questions and move through this. We may have to bring you back at some point. I'm not sure. We'll see how it goes. So thank you, Mr. Strauss.
Well, I appreciate everyone's time, and if you'd like to have me back, I'd be happy to join you again.
Okay. Now, who we didn't get to was Ms. Rena Miller, with the Special Assistant to the Commissioner of Natural Resources. So, Ms. Miller, I think we would hope to bring you back next Wednesday.
Mr. Okay. Chair, we're happy to be back at your convenience.
Okay. So my plan is for us to focus on this bill, HB 49, for the next few weeks. With regard to the question on testimony, we still can accept written testimony to house.resources@akledge.gov. Okay. With that, I'll set HB 49 aside. Is there any other business before the committee today? Seeing none, the next committee meeting will be held at 1 o'clock on Wednesday, March 8th. As I mentioned before, there's no meeting Friday and no meeting Monday. So our meeting today is adjourned at 3:08 p.m.